Thanks for listening to the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast. You can contact the show at twitter.com/DW Groovecast and through Facebook at facebook.com/Drummer's Weekly Groovecast.
Good evening.
I am warning you right now, if you touch my drums, I will stab you in the neck with a knife.
Ain't a fucking. Ain't a fucking.
Mom!
Take it easy. Lower it.
I'm not going to lower it. I have to do this now.
I don't mind you playing it, but lower it.
We get straight out?
No, we had a problem. I mean, we tried to do everything we could.
What do you mean?
Well, you know what I mean.
Nice! Little trouble there. You're rushing.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Yeah!
Hello, folks of Groovecast Nation. Phil here. Happy Monday. We're going to get your week started off right, and I do mean right. John and I made a quick trip over to Athens, Georgia this past week. We reached out to Mr. Adam Deitch from Lettuce, and he said, without hesitation, get over here. Let's talk drums. Let's talk music. And brother, he did not disappoint. Before we jump right into this thing, I want to go ahead and extend a humble and warm welcome to all the fans from Lettuce, fans of Break Science. Probably going to have some folks that dig the Average White Band and John Schofield as well tuning into this, as well as our regular listeners and all of our drum geek, drumhead followers all over this big blue globe. So, if you would, tell us what you think about this. Tell us what you like about it. Reach out to us at drummersweeklygroovecast@gmail.com, twitter.com/DW Groovecast. And you can also interact with us at Facebook, facebook.com/DrummersWeeklyGroovecast. So without any further ado, we're going to tease you by leading in with a little bit of Lettuce from their newest album, Mount Crushmore. And let's get the show started. Adam Deitch, folks. John, we are not in Atlanta, sir.
No, sir. Made a little road trip.
Doesn't look a thing like it. As a matter of fact, I'm going to say the studio we're recording in today is an upgrade.
Yeah, I'm feeling big time right now.
Well, we should let the cat out of the bag here right now that we're on a tour bus right now. We've hit the big time, the little podcast that could, we're on a tour bus here with our friend from the band Lettuce, Mr. Adam Deitch. Adam, say hello to the folks.
How you guys doing? Glad to be here.
Man, we're glad to have you on here, man. We appreciate you inviting us out.
No problem, man.
Well, we're going to go ahead and tell everybody that since we're on the front lounge of the bus, anybody who's ever traveled on a bus before knows that, especially before show times, it gets a little bit busy from time to time. But we're easy going, man. We're just taking it easy, man. We know what it's like on here. So people coming and going, it's cool. No big deal.
Okay.
There's
Hey, perfect. Yeah.
there's a Waffle House next door. And so so people are coming and going.
Thanks, Nigel.
Yeah.
Well, hey, man, per our episode last week talking about relationships, it is for that very reason that we were able to connect with Adam and our buddy Fred Vigdor.
Mm-hmm. Big shout out to Freddie.
Told him we were almost legit. And he was gracious enough to give us his time. So
yeah,
there you go, people.
Yeah, so thanks to Freddie V for hooking us up on this. And, you know, before we go ahead and jump in and start throwing questions at Adam, I want to go ahead and say that we're not going to ask the normal questions to Adam that everybody does. Ooh. We're going to do a few things differently, because let me say this. We always task our listening audience to do their homework on these people before we actually even do the interviews, because some of these people that we interview have been interviewed several times before. Right. And so we're not going to go down that whole line of like, so Adam, tell us when you started playing. Yeah. We kind of know that stuff. So we're going to throw some curveballs at you today.
I'm ready for it. So
everybody listening to this, do your homework on Adam. He's been interviewed in Modern Drummer, and he's also done a couple of different podcasts before. So listen to those, and then some of these questions that we're going to be asking him are going to make more sense whenever you hear about it. Okay, so Adam, we're going to go ahead and start out and by telling everybody, we know that you grew up with parents that were both drummers. And
correct.
It's pretty well known in some of your interviews also that you started when you were very, very young. But one of the stumbling blocks that you had, or one of the things that kind of came across as being something that was formative in your lifetime, is you told some folks that you had ADD. Yeah. And so... First question right out of the gate I want to ask you is, how did that affect either when you first started playing, your will to play, or even just your ability, or as far as like what went on in your mind as far as playing?
Well, I don't know if it was ever actually diagnosed that I had ADD, but it is my initials because my middle name's David. So
my middle name's David too, so I'm liking this so far. Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of kids are hyper and some are, it's harder to learn certain things, you know, and for me it was hard to learn to read and do kind of the normal lesson way of doing it. And my parents, even though they're both music teachers and accomplished drummers, and they both play piano, for them to teach me wasn't an easy task. And they, you know, my dad had to kind of come up with a different way of teaching me, I guess, and it was based on him playing and me playing and hearing my mom play, and once they got me on stage with them playing just 2 and 4, that's when it kind of clicked. And I guess, you know, a thing that a lot of ADD people have, they say, is a thing called hyperfocus.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you can't focus on anything until you find something you really love. And some kids find that thing and some kids don't, you know. And I just found that, you know, with drums and with music in general, but especially drums, that was my hyper focus, and I would zone out for hours and hours and hours and just do it and just play.
Hip, man. So with your parents also, of course, like we've just mentioned, being drummers and being professional drummers, did you ever feel any kind of either pressure from them to excel, and or did you subconsciously or even consciously put pressure on yourself knowing that?
Yeah, there was a little bit of pressure. You know, my mom was a consummate professional, and she was a drummer, and my dad was a keyboard player, and they had a duo. And so, you know, I had to, when I sat in on gigs when I was 5, 6, 7 years old, my mom kind of was, you know, she was happy that I was doing it, but it was definitely like, be professional and play the beat and play the song. And, you know, so it was kind of, you know, she would give me a look sometimes if I get off. You know, so I learned on their gigs, and you know, there was just a little bit of pressure, fun pressure, not like I know kids that have classical, you know, people that grew up with classical parents, and they would have to play recitals, and they can't mess up one note. It wasn't that kind of pressure. It was like, they're very loving, amazing people. So the pressure to succeed, and the pressure to, you know, where they became parents and kind of gave up traveling and becoming professional musicians, as far as traveling or in a band, they kind of worked locally. And my job was sort of to, I guess, maybe spread the family name out a little bit, you know, and let people know that the Deitches are a drum family, you know, and we got a lot of drums for the world.
Yeah, man. Cool. So the cool thing that I kind of got out of that is it was not necessarily anxiety-inducing sort of pressure.
Nah,
you know?
I mean, I've, you know, very minuscule anxiety, but mostly it was love and fun. Yeah,
good. Cool.
Well, near and dear to my heart, I in an interview I heard you mention that they, in turn, would teach some kids that had some learning disabilities,
yep. Mm-hmm.
Autism, that kind of thing. And I'm a parent of a high-functioning autistic child who's showing a great deal of musical ability.
It's real.
What exactly, was it more of like on an individual approach they'd go with kids, or was there a method that they would do?
Well, yeah, the school was called Summit School, and it's in Nyack, New York, and it was down the street from our house. And my dad would walk to work, and he was the music teacher there, and they were all various different forms of learning disabilities and behavioral problems and all kinds of different things.
Levels of spectrum.
Different levels of stuff. And, and you know, I got to meet, I think his name was Pete something, and he had severe Tourette's. And he was, when you heard him on the piano, it was like hearing an amazing, you know, like he really could play piano. And that's when I first, it clicked in my mind that, you know, just because you have a disability doesn't mean you can't be a genius musician or an artist, or, you know.
Many.
And I learned this really young, and my dad, you know, devised methods for everybody to feel good about themselves, and by playing certain, you know, tunes or certain chord sequences that were easy to learn. And he watched people just, you know, their hearts just, you know, become in love with music and love with music class. And they kind of held him on this pedestal, like, wow, Mr. Deitch was like, you know, just the way he was with them, and so good. Like, you know, he didn't have a degree in musical therapy, but to me, he's got his doctorate in musical therapy, you know. And so he wrote this book, this drum book, which he, you know, devised for the kids, which is actually good for teaching anyone how to play drum beats. And it's the number system. It has nothing to do with regular notation. And it's called The Drummer in You.
The Drummer.
And I, you know, if even try it on your, you know, siblings or your family at Christmas time. You know, if you got a kid in the house, and watch them, all of a sudden they're playing a beat, and watch their eyes light up. And it works every time. You know, it's an amazing book. And that's Peter awesome. Erskine uses it at his college where he teaches, actually, I heard. So
I love that, man. Thanks for sharing that. That's cool. Man. I'm going to check that book out for sure. Man.
That's very cool. Adam, I suppose it probably goes without saying that your dad and your mom were your first drum teachers, right?
Absolutely.
Now, outside of that, there probably had to be a time where both of them even encouraged you to, like, hey, it's time to get you out of the house and do some drum lessons.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your age and who your first proper or outside of the house drum teacher was.
Right on. I mostly did piano lessons early on. That was my first out of house lesson experience.
That's it, man. Yeah.
And you know, I had a few piano teachers that were great. And then around 10 or 11, it was time to get me out of the house. And the local drum store in Nyack, New York, Long Island Drum Center.
That name might come back again in this podcast. Yeah. You'll see later.
Yeah, that Long Island Drum Center is where it all went down for me. It was like my little drum haven away from home. And there was, you know, it's like, cause I grew up with just drum sets in the house, drums everywhere. So I feel comfortable any place like that. So I got to meet Frank Marino, who was the guy that took me into another stratosphere of thought and, you know, he was a Tony Williams head, he was an Elvin Jones head, he was a Jack DeJohnette head, and he also loved, you know, Vinny, and he loved Smitty, and he loved Dennis, and like just the creme de la creme of, you know, like Roy Haynes, and he was just into everybody, and he really exposed me to so many amazing drummers that my parents hadn't, you know, my parents did their best to give me an overall of what they could by the time I was 10, you know.
Just exposure to music.
Exposure to everything, right. From the Beatles to like, you know, a Love Supreme, you know, and like everything in between, Earth, Wind & Fire, every Stevie Wonder record, every Donny Hathaway, you know. But then Frank expanded into, I guess, fusion, and he had his own group that would play like once in a while, once a month, and they were like really out kind of fusion funk kind of vibe and almost avant-garde fusion funk. And yeah, so he, Frank Marino was an amazing teacher, and I recommend anyone in the New York area to seek this guy out and just hang with him and check out his philosophies. He wrote a book called Time Capsule that's really advanced, and he studied with, he was friends with Frankie Malibé, who's a New York conguero legend, Cuban legend, and he also wrote the drum set rhythms for those particular bata rhythms. He like wrote
Afro-Cuban rhythms for drum set.
For drum set, totally. So, you know, Frank was deep into that. So he had me playing like, you know, clave and wawanko and all kinds of different Latin rhythms right away. You know, 11, 12, 13. I was like trying to voice conga stuff with the in-betweens, slaps, and you know, on a drum set, you know, and that kind of opened my mind up. And he was, you know,
it's
really
a whole other language.
Yeah, far out concepts so awesome. Of quintuplets and septuplets, and you know, and odd bars and all that stuff. And he just really took me to an advanced level. So definitely loved him. And Tony Cruz, who was a great disciplinarian, and he's the guy that told me that I was going to go to Berkeley and fall on my face because I couldn't read, you know, as well as I should have. And he wasn't scared to tell me, like, you have to get your reading up. Like,
how old were you when he told you that?
That was about 14, 15. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Did it take? I mean, did you focus on that?
Yeah, we did snare drum etudes out of a book, and he would just like yell at me if I spaced out, and like, yeah, you know, clap and just keep me going. And it made me mad at those times. I was into skateboarding around that time, and you know, and I was just like, I don't want to read snare etudes, you know. And he was like, we're doing this. So I think my parents knew what they were doing, sending me to Tony.
Yeah,
you know,
I probably should have gone to him.
And I appreciate what he did. He could groove too. He's a great funky drummer. And a lot of strange independence exercises that I couldn't play at all, and it made me mad, you know. And so I kept trying these different, you know, like funky, weird things that I thought made no sense at then. Now I do it during my solos and play it all the time, you know.
Yeah, man, when you think back on those teachers like Cruz and Malaby, now Malaby obviously had you working on the
well, Latin. I didn't study with Frank Malaby, I studied with Frank Marino.
Frank Marino,
yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who was Frankie Malaby's friend. Yeah.
Gotcha. I am guessing that, like, probably one of those books that Cruz probably had you work out of, was that like one of the Wilcoxon snare drum etude books? Or
he had them all, man. He had a stack of snare books, you know.
Yeah.
I can't remember what books they were. It was like, you know, 9-stroke rolls and 16, you know, all those things, you know. And
right,
and just really kicked my butt.
Is that how he approached working with you on Rudiments, or did he also just kind of go like, look at him, you got to do your freaking 5-stroke rolls and 7-stroke rolls?
Yeah.
Did he do that in tandem with it, or was it all just in those books primarily?
I mean, you know, I knew most of the rolls, and I had a basic rudimentary, you know, thing happening, but that's where it got to the next level. And he's like, yeah, I know you can play, I know you can groove. And, you know, I had at that point, I was playing like a couple gigs a week, you know, whether it was a church gig on Sundays or whatever. And so he just was like, let's work on these snare drum stuff, you know. So that helped me out with just getting to Berkeley and be able to read a little bit and, you know, and be aware of what's happening on paper, you know.
Yeah, man. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, you had mentioned that these teachers had opened you up to like Jack D and Tony and Elvin. Now, saying that, you know, for like a 12 to 14 year old, I mean, that's pretty heady stuff, you know. For who were you when you put your iPod on, or when you turned the radio on, what were you listening to? And more importantly, who were the drummers that were like really speaking to you when you were at that age?
Yeah, I was a really weird kid, you know. I just had my parents' record collection, and I really loved the Brecker Brothers. Like, I was just that weird 12-year-old kid that was playing along with heavy metal bebop and listening to Basio, and, you know, Skunk Funk was my favorite tune, and Night Sprite and all that stuff. Gab was on Night Sprite. And I would play along with these records all the time. And, you know, I really loved playing with Earth, Wind & Fire records because I would get this rush and my hair in the back of my neck would stand up when I'd play along with it and turn it up loud on the phones and just, you know, go through like the best of Earth, Wind & Fire collection. And then, you know, Open Our Eyes was a great record to play along with. And I would just love the rush that I would get from that. And, you know, you leave the studio floating a little bit after you play with those records, you know.
I just revisited I Am not too long ago.
Yes.
And I mean, you always hear something new, but it's just, you know, Maurice being gone now, I was thinking about him, his production, Freddie, of course.
They're masterpieces.
Just
all, you know,
stunning, man.
They're really masterpieces, and there's so much in them. You can always go back to them, you know. It's like a good movie where you want to, eventually, you know, every piece. Like Nigel, my friend, the keyboard player in Lettuce, he knows every note like that's being played on, you know, on every instrument. And I don't say that lightly. And you know, we go back to the records over and over again, and it reminds me of those days when I first discovered it, and from, you know, going through my parents' records and
just stuff you love just unconditionally.
Yeah.
And that's a good time, man. That's why we all got into what we're doing.
Yeah, man.
And those records for me, there's two or three, especially with Earth, Wind & Fire. It's like
Earth, Wind & Fire just was amazing. The best just to play with. And, you know, I got a little bit into hip hop stuff. I was like enjoying playing along with like some hip hop tapes. I had like a boombox in the basement next to the drum set, and I put my little tapes in, hip hop tapes, whatever it was, Fat Boys or Curtis Blow, like the early days, like 87, 88. And, you know, I was about, you know, 10 years old, 12 years old, and that's, so I started playing along with that. And then I, you know, a little older, I got into a little Primus. I wanted to relate to some people my own age, so I got into some Primus, some Chili Peppers, and, you know, and I felt like Chili Peppers were an extension of, you know, like the funky rock thing, the funkadelic thing, yeah. You know, and yeah, so I really dug them, and yeah, 24/7 Spies, another great band, Fishbone was great, you know, yeah. You know, the rockier side of things, so I didn't want to be like a, you know, I like to hit drums, and you know, so I kind of enjoyed playing along with those records. They kind of helped shape my sound a little bit too, you know, so I wouldn't be a too much of a light hitter or too much of a heavy hitter, like kind of approach it from all sides, you know.
Hit, man. Now, I heard in another interview that there was a period of time when you got heavily into skateboarding.
Yeah.
Man, was that, when you look back on that now, was that some kind of a conscious or subconscious rebellious thing?
In a way it was, you know.
You know?
Just, yeah. That's a great question. You know, I was in my house a lot more than most kids, because, you know, one, I love playing the drums. Two, my mom wanted to keep me in the house. You know, only child, like, she's a little, you know, she didn't really want me out. Like, I wasn't allowed to do all the things all my friends were allowed to do. And skateboarding was a way for me to get out of the house. You know, just because I, you know, I was always playing drums, and my parents are so cool that, you know, at a certain point, 13, my friends are like, we're going skateboarding, we're going to the city, and we're gonna, you know, someone's gonna drive, you know, I'd like sneak off into the city. I live like 40 minutes from the city, you know, mm-hmm. And I was not supposed to go there at 14 years old or 15, especially in 1992, 3, when it was pretty funky, you know?
Yeah.
But I was there, I was skating around the city and going to the Bronx and like finding skate parks, you know, so it was kind of like a rush, and, you know, your heart's beating fast because you're skating faster and doing things higher. So, yeah, it was great. And, you know, I'm glad I got away a little bit from drums a little bit. It was kind of obsessive growing up. Like,
Sort of balance. Balance isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
Some other interests.
Yeah, definitely.
It's good to have balance. We know people who don't have those, and they can be a little.
Right. And I could see guys who, sometimes I could spot them out, the guys that don't have other interests.
Right.
The drummer. You hear like music, like, that guy doesn't really do much else, does he? Like, because they sound so technical, maybe, or like something like. I feel like those couple years off gave me a little bit of just like looseness, a little rough around the edges to my playing, where, you know, I don't want to be like perfectly, you know, metronomic or quantized or anything like that. I want it to feel natural. So,
see, Phil? Some of us just like being loose.
Yeah, man.
It's not a crime.
Ringo, man.
Yeah. Do you still skate, man, by any chance?
You know what? I don't skate that often anymore because if I break my wrist now, I fell a couple times in the past couple months where, like, just it takes one rock to go skid and your board stops and you fly. And if you're not ready for it, you could crack a wrist, you know? So it's like, I owe it to my friends who, this is their job and this is our life and this is our corporation and this is, mm-hmm. you know, so not to show up to work with a cast on my arm, you know. As much as I love it, I'll skate to the store, I'll skate around, but I'm not doing my old tricks or nothing like that. You know?
Now I'm going to hold your feet to the fire, man. I saw Josh Freese play with a broken leg one time.
Wow.
So.
Wow.
We don't talk about aliens on this podcast.
Yeah. I bet he was killing too. I
mean. No doubt.
Yeah. So cool, man. So we've kind of taken a little bit of a different tour, getting up to the point, man, to where you ended up going to Berkeley, and uh-huh. and there's a little bit of a story again that I heard on another interview where, essentially, your mom kind of pushed you into or encouraged you to go to like a summer camp,
yeah.
right up
yeah.
there. And correct me if I'm wrong, but when you went to that camp, that actually has roots in starting this band, right?
Mm, absolutely.
So tell us just for a minute. You were probably in the height of like skate fandom, right,
yeah.
at that time,
totally,
right?
Totally.
And then all of a sudden, it's like, hey, I'm going to Boston, and yep. I'm going to do this. So how was it like a 2 week or like a 4 week?
Kind 5 week thing? Program.
5 week program.
Yeah. Yep.
Just give us the rundown of how that went for you and how that kind of reignited the drum spark.
Yeah, I looked at it. I was like, I'm going to go skateboard in Boston for the summer, you know, and maybe play a little drums. I had a little bit of nervousness because I thought that Berkeley was all Dennis Chambers's, all Omar Hakim's and Vinnie Caliuta's, and I was going to go there just this like sloppy, you know, like guy who could, you know, I didn't know any facility or chops wise on the drum. I was just kind of like groove player, and I didn't think anyone would dig that because it was like, you know, I was aware of the fusion 90s and what was going on. I just thought I was going to get just murdered there. So I went there just with no expectations and just brought my board and I took my mother's old drum set, which was like this, I don't know what it was, like some weird drums. They had no bottom heads and they barely stepped. They're like white, they're old 70s messed up drums. And I just carry them around and like, you know, it was a joke. And then I met Shmeens the first day. I set him up in this little practice room, and the guitar player, Adam Smirnoff, and he was next door to me, and he was playing some funky rock stuff, and I heard him play, and I knocked on his door and said, will you come in to my practice room, set up your guitar in my practice room. And around the same time is when I met Eric Coombs, our bass player, Eric Jesus Coombs, and we went to a jam session. And we happened to both walk into this at the same time, and Little John Roberts was playing, and it just blew us away. It was to this day, it was so powerful because he was either about to leave with Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince or just come back from them, and he had this real hip hop swing funk, like the Chronicle thing, that I had never seen anyone play like that, like professional hip hop sound, you know,
such
like
a man, yeah.
Oh man, and he was hitting hard, and a great bass player was there that day, Chris Laughlin, Chris, who one of our biggest inspirations. He took me under his wing when I went to school, and so you know, this is, you know, we were kids and we saw this, and it blew us away, man. And then I introduced, I guess I don't know if I introduced Eric to Adam, but we all ended up meeting up and. And then someone knew Eric Krasno, and it all just kind of pieced together right there, you know, and we started jamming, started playing together.
Cool, man. And then that ended up the kind of cruel circumstance to that was, man, is you had that great experience, then you had to go back home for a couple of years, literally.
By the end of the 5 week, we had become such good friends. We were like a gang, you know, because people, you know, these young kids, 16-year-olds that went to this 5 week, they were kind of more of the timid side, kind of away from home the first time, a little homesick, and young, maybe too young to have that college experience where we went, bam, this is our new gang, you know, like, this is our new, let's come back here quick.
Well, let's some of that, back, you know, kind like, of based on, like, you know, you said you had preconceived notions of what type of players and all that. And
yeah.
Almost inevitably, you're going to connect if these guys are kind of into your thing.
Yeah, they gave me confidence.
That had to be liberating, man.
It was really liberating. We all, like, for confidence level and for, you know, just, you know, their whole thing was just like when you groove with Eric on the bass and Smirnoff's on guitar and he's grooving, like, that is special and, like, and that's what needs to happen, you know? And I felt like, wow, I have a place on the earth, you know? It felt like a puzzle or a, you know, so that just fit together, you know?
Yeah.
So I was like, wow, you know, we have to come back to school and do this again, you know? And I think Jesus was a year younger than us, and he finished high school a year early to come to school, like, when we all did, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's how it all went down. So thanks to those guys for allowing me to even believe that I could become a musician, you know? And we all kind of did that for each other, because we all had these, like, oh, you know, Jesus, I'm not Patitucci, or I'm not this. It's like, don't worry about that. Be yourselves, groove, and find people that you sound good with, you
That's
know?
The thing. We were just driving up here, we were talking about chemistry, and it's just undeniable. We've all experienced it, and fortunately for you, it was early and magic.
Magic,
but you can't replace that. Yeah. I don't care, you know, the four baddest cats in the world. Doesn't mean it's going to work.
Doesn't mean it's going to work. Yeah. So, you know, we had some weird magic happen. And yeah, that's why we went back to school. And
I just think that's how it happens with a lot of bands that we know and love. You know, there it is.
Yeah, man.
So, man, you get done with this program. You go home. You tell your parents that it's a smashing success. And I know they've got to be on cloud nine.
Yeah.
Right. Thinking, man, this is great. Because aside from you following in their footsteps as far as playing drums, you're going to the same school they went to.
Yeah,
I mean that's a big deal.
And I was into it now.
And you were
ready
into
to go, and they were like, "It worked."
So, you know, man, when you then applied to Berklee and then got accepted, did you have to go through any kind of an audition process? Yeah. Did you end up getting scholarships, any of that kind of thing?
My dad had this idea to do a VHS video to send to the scholarship department. And I did all the sequencing on his synthesizers, on his keyboards, and made like these like intense Latin fusion tunes on the keyboard. Then I did, you know, played drums over the top, and we videoed the whole thing. It's like way before it was like I'm trying to make my own DCI video, basically. You
nice.
Know? And sent it to them, and I guess the guy in charge of scholarships dug it, and I got, you know, maybe, you know, a couple thousand off, you know, tuition, whatever, per year, and which was great. And yeah, so and I was excited, and then they were stoked that I was going back to school.
So when you got up there, this is a question I like to ask everybody. Were you into the classes up there? Like, you know, you had to take theory and ear training.
Yeah, absolutely.
History. So, and you were into that.
Yeah, I was digging it, man. We had some great teachers, you know, from, you know, the ear training stuff. We had some guys that really got us to know our intervals. And, you know, that's what I use today still, you know. With, you know, I like to use function. I don't do solfege, you know, like, but, you know, to be able to tell someone, no, it's the minor seven, or it's the flat six, or it's the sharp five, or just, you know, knowing your intervals and knowing the function of what, you know, despite the key, and just, you know, things like that, I could tell anyone, no, the harmony's the fifth, start with the fifth, or, you know, that kind of thing. Like, to not know that and to be in a band, I think it kind of, like, makes you a mute, because you don't really know how to tell the guitar player, you know what, I think, or the harmony, it might be better if you try the minor third over that, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, it's, you know, so everyone speaks function in the band, you know.
Man, I am really glad to hear you say that, because sometimes with some of my students, it's hard to relate to them from the standpoint that knowing, you know, basic theory as far as, like, you know, chord qualities and, like you said, intervals and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Man, if you don't have that, of course you can function in a band as a drummer, but it certainly limits you to a point to where you're kind of a nonverbal member when it comes to the actual writing aspect of it. So that's, man, that's great to hear. Yeah. I want to make sure all,
you know, you know, theory can be overwhelming if you look at it, the enormity of what's there and how advanced it can get. But sometimes as a drum teacher, giving students a basic thing that's going to help them in their band, you know, like that kind of theory, like, you know, is it a minor chord? Is it a major chord? Is it a minor seven? Is it a major seven? Is it, you know, like just knowing a couple chords and how to voice them, you know, what they sound like. And, you know, like I said, intervals and things like that, what kind of scales, major, minor, you know, knowing your diminished chords, your augmented chords, there's things like that is really going to help you out as far as writing songs, hanging out with your guitar player and bass player, and you speak their language now, and then your bond gets closer because you're speaking to them like another guitar player, or you talk to a keyboard player like a keyboard player, in a sense, you know, and that was always my goal with you know, kind of getting to know the guys and, you know, kind of be able to speak their language, you know.
Man, who were some of your applied teachers? Applied drum set teachers at Berklee?
I mean, I had a couple great. My first one was Jamie Haddad, who's one of the greatest people and, you know, percussionists ever. You know, he's with Paul Simon, and he's just really, he went to school with my parents, actually. So I think he recognized my name, and I went into the lesson on the first day and went, "Your parents Bobby and Denise or something like that?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Oh man," he's like, "you can already play shit, you know." He was like, and he, you know, he did this thing where he had this guest, he always has a lot of friends of his coming into classes, like he had this, like, two Indian cats that were friends of his that were visiting at the time in my first lesson, and he turned the lights off, dimmed the lights, and he maybe put some incense, and he said, "You guys just have a conversation on the kit." And he put, like, this guy on a kit and put me on a kit, and we just had a conversation, you know. And I never even heard, like, thought of drums as a conversation until that, you know. So he was brilliant and really unorthodox teacher, and just the kind of teacher you're like, wow, this is going to be a great semester, you know. I'm with Jamie Haddad.
That sounds like a good fit for you, where your head was and all that.
It was absolutely perfect. And I knew about him. I think my parents might say, "Study with Jamie. He's great. You know, like, you know, so... He was awesome. And then the advanced level was Dave DiCenzo, who's a man, he's unlimited. Mm-hmm. He just has really unlimited. I heard him through a door that was locked. He was practicing in a room, and I thought it was Dennis Chambers that was just there for the day. the stuff that he was playing that day just sounded like it could have been Dennis or Smitty or Vinny. And I was like, who could this possibly be? Because I've heard them all and I've seen them all live. So I knocked on the door and this guy came out with long hair looking like a rocker, you know, and I'm like, wow, I was like blown away, you know, because he was really funky, you know. And so then, you know, he was one of the greatest teachers I ever had, and technique wise and just his method of playing the cascada pattern around the drum set and using that and filling it up with 30 seconds and flowing and using the hi-hat as a tom-tom. And he's just really just limitless stuff. And another teacher I have to mention is Kenwood Denard, who is a classic, one of the greatest teachers, spiritual advisors you'll ever meet. And, you know, he was, his time with Jaco was incredible, and his time, you know, everything he's done in his career is incredible. And I'm just a huge fan of him, and, you know, he's a genius with teaching.
I'm going to do a little callback to Kenwood Denard and to Little John Roberts.
We can talk about the Maceo record if you want.
Yeah, exactly. Check this out, man. We ask
energy, man.
We ask John, who's your favorite underrated drummer? Immediately, Kenwood Denard.
He's like Kenwood, huh?
Yeah. Immediately, Kenwood Denard.
I hear that. Yeah. I don't even consider Kenwood a drummer. He's like a... He's a musician from outer space. He can play drums and keyboards at the same time. Mm-hmm. He can rap while he plays. He can sing while he plays. He can do all those things. He's an alien, you know? He's a musician. He's like more than just this guy that can burn people on drums. He can do that, you know? But he's a force of nature, just musically, you know?
He's recently been posting some clips of this group that he's out with, Brand X.
Yeah.
Killing, man.
I got to see that.
Yeah.
I'll expect you to send me those clips.
It's killing, man. Yeah, it absolutely is. Now, one of the biggest things that I tell students about music school that is one of the most important things is the time you spend playing in different ensembles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are some of the ensembles you played in up at Berklee?
Well, the best one was the James Brown Ensemble, taught by Kenwood Denard.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
And that class was most of my Lettuce guys. I had my Eric Coombs on bass and Adam Smirnoff on guitar. And we had some other people. We had De'Anthony Parks, who ended up Mars Volta fame. And
he's from Atlanta. So.
Yeah. You know, he's doing Techno Self. If you haven't heard of Techno Self, listeners, check it out. Mm-hmm. And we ended up in the, you know, the Kenwood Denard, James Brown Ensemble together with two kits. And I was like, who is this guy? He's incredible. And Kenwood knew there was some magic happening because we just sunk right in to the thing, you know. And so next thing you know, we're playing, the class would leave and me, him, and Kenwood would play three kits in his room sometimes for an hour or two, you know, until I was tired. And then they would go at it like a young wolf versus an old wolf, or, you know, like, yeah. Like it would be incredible. Like, they're both sweating to the point where De'Anthony would fall over and almost collapse after, you know. And it was a really incredible meeting of the minds. That was a great ensemble. And
man, that guy is, talk about it, at the forefront right now.
Oh man, he's an artist. He's the Warhol of drums, or Basquiat of drums, you know. Like, to me, like, he's an artist, you know. True artist. His videos, the way his Instagram is, his picture, he just did his movie scores, you know. Like, he's I knew it. The second I heard him and met him and shook his hand, I was like, this guy's special. You know, this guy's really special.
Man, now, Berklee has morphed itself so many different ways, man, over the last 20 years or so. But it's still, even to this day, if you ask people, and especially older people, they always go, well, you know, that's a great jazz school. Mm. Did you play in any of those jazz ensembles, man, like the Coltrane Ensemble or
I was in one ensemble with this amazing vibraphonist. He was the teacher. It's been a while, y'all. It's been a while. Yeah. It might come to me later. But yeah, I did get to play a little bit of Straight Ahead. And it was crazy because at the time I was friends with a couple of the older, the seniors and juniors and seniors in the school. And they were really amazing jazz musicians. They were phenomenal. There was Mark Simmons. There was Charles Haynes. There was Kendrick Scott. You know, guys like that were playing straight ahead, that when you saw them play jazz and real straight ahead, real swing, you were blown away. And you realize, and I was intimidated to even go anywhere near it. I tried, I just, the way they played it, I was like, wow, I gotta stick to my thing, you know. Like, yeah. Some guys can play both, you know. Some guys, you know, I call them like the freaks that could really funk your face off in an R&B context or play some funky fusion and then really swing with a touch,
almost like a different drummer,
yeah, like a different cat. And there was a few guys like that at Berkeley, and you know, I was like, wow, that's maybe when I'm 90, you know, if I could live that long, if I could just kind of keep thinking about being a well-rounded kind of drummer. But yeah, that's, you know, that's something you see at Berkeley that blew my mind. Yeah, so I just try to be as well-rounded as, you know, as possible with that.
Hit, man. And so to kind of wrap up Berkeley and then start moving towards professional life, we'll call it, is there one in particular, one person, maybe like Ken Wood or someone else, that you would consider to be like your mentor when you were up there?
Yeah, as far as drum wise or
man, even life wise.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, at Wally's it was very important. I had a lot of mentors there.
And let's talk about Wally's even for a second.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Wally's,
that name has come up several times on this show.
Yeah, yeah. It was real serious. You know, it's called Wally's because of Joseph Walcott. You know, was one of the first African American club owners in Boston, and I heard a rumor that Tony Williams used to live upstairs from there. Did you guys hear that?
No, but
yeah, or he used to live across the street, or right, and
yeah, he's from there. He's from
Boston.
His
father was bringing him in there when he was young, and Roy Haynes is also from Boston, so maybe young Tony got to see Roy in his prime playing a little club like Wally's. That probably why Tony is the next extension of Roy.
Right,
you know,
certainly,
like,
makes sense.
There's some history in there. And then, like, Branford was in there during, when he was in school. Winton was in there. You know, like, it just has a lot of history. And then the funk night started with legit cats. You know, it wasn't like just, you know, a regular R&B jam. It was like, you know, Lil Jon Roberts and, you know, a lot of great. I played with Roy Hargrove, came through and sat in with my band there, you know, and I got to play with like great musicians there, you know. So that spot really inspired us to go to the next level. And guys like Jeff Lockhart, who's a phenomenal guitar player, one of the most underrated guitar players ever in history, is just, you know, as funky as, you know, like Freddie Stone from Silent Family Stone, that kind of funk, like, you know, move the whole club. And then he could get into any sort of vibe, whether it's Eastern, whether it's Jimi Hendrix, whether it's pure funk and fusion and whatever. So he was kind of like my mentor. And then Chris Laughlin, again, the bass player, just a phenomenal bass player, plays with Brian McKnight, and he took care of us and made sure that we felt comfortable and played our best and had fun.
Well, you guys earlier had mentioned that besides the obvious John Roberts and company setting the bar high, but now you're, you know, looking to some of the guys that are coming out of there,
yeah,
helping them out and all that. And that's a fertile and important scene, man.
It is.
Like,
it is.
So many players coming out of there. That place is really held in high regard. And I love that because at the end of the day, that's what we're all about.
Yep.
Relationships and picking the next guy up and believing in this guy and that guy.
Yeah, man.
Pushing people.
Absolutely.
So, you know, obviously, listeners, if you're in Boston, that seems to be the place.
The last time I was there, I believe Stevie Wonder was in town playing in Boston, and the entire Stevie Wonder band came down with Lil Jon. I was two Wally's, and we had a hang, and John played, and they all played, and it was just like the heyday, like, you know, because if the house band's already at a certain level, and then someone from out of town comes in like that.
Like Stevie Wonder's band.
And yeah, like Stevie, like that, you know, and then it's through the roof. The energy is unbelievable. And and that's something I'll always keep close to my heart, for sure.
Well, kudos to you guys too, man, carrying that torch. And
I mean,
you know, there's kids that think the world of you guys giving them the encouragement.
Oh, right on. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's so many young guys coming out of there, you know.
And scary, isn't it?
You know, we got to all take care of, you know, like, it's a, yeah, I got helped out, you know, I got the Average White Band gig through that, and that's so, you know, that's how it happened.
So, Adam, is that the gig that got you out of Berkeley then, Average White Band?
Yeah, that put me on a national scale and, like, put me in front of, you know, audiences nightly, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Now, there's a story, and I'll have you kind of talk about how you actually got that gig where you actually didn't get it, and then you got so to speak. Run that by us real quick.
I mean, so long ago. I auditioned for it. This is just a lesson for people that go to auditions, if you're a drummer, if you're auditioning. If you don't get the gig, be as cool as possible. You know, shake everyone's hands and congratulate the winner. And if you can, and just be cool and say, and don't get an attitude, because I got called 6 months after the audition because the drummer they had picked just didn't want to do it anymore. And there was an opening where, a lot of times the door would have been closed and it opened back up, and
ended up being a great lesson, gig. Man.
Yeah.
And you had that for roughly 3 years or so, right?
Yeah, about that, yeah.
Yeah. There was a great story on one of the shows that I heard you talking about where you played a gig in front of Steve Ferroni.
Oh, yeah.
And let me tell you, I'm gonna give you a big compliment on something here because it's in a roundabout way. It involves Steve Jordan about something that he told me one time. And the story that you told was that this gig that you played with Average White Band, that you were doing some things that were kind of, you called it kind of like, it was like grooves on steroids, so
yeah,
to speak.
It was like the hip-hop version of the song, the Eric B. and Rakim sampled version with the extra kick drum parts from their record on top of the Average White Band sample. I was playing that.
Right. Well, man, I went to school part-time in Memphis, and I met Steve Jordan over there one time, and he did a master class over there. He said something, man, that I will never forget that directly relates to kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
He was saying, man, you know, to everybody that was there, man, you guys don't, I don't know if you realize what kind of like a musical heritage and a drumming heritage you got here in Memphis. And one of the things that he said was back when he, I guess it was probably in the late 70s, he was doing that gig with the Blues Brothers, and they were playing a lot of Memphis stuff back at that time. And of course, when you're doing that stuff, man, you're covering Al Jackson parts. And he said the biggest regret that he had, man, on that gig was that he didn't listen to, at that time, those records close enough, and he was not copping those.
What year was this?
Man, this was the early 90s when he told me
this. Right, because that version of Steve Jordan, that's the Steve Jordan that I was loving that. I mean, I love all versions of Steve Jordan, but like, when Steve played with Scofield, a lot of people don't know Steve really crushed, I think, one or two albums with Scofield.
Electric Outlet.
Yeah, Electric Outlet, that's the one. And I was all over that, and that's not throwback funky Al Jackson.
No,
Steve Jordan.
That's a record too.
That's like advanced fusion funk.
I've used that record. I've used tunes off that record as like joiner music on this podcast.
Yeah,
Electric Outlet is one of the baddest records.
Yes, I had the tape, the planet. And I was all about it. And actually, one of the tunes off that is the first tune I ever played with Scofield, with Lettuce. When Scofield came to New York. And he had new soul of it, and the guitar player invited him to sit in with Lettuce. He goes, "What do you want to play?" And we picked one of the tunes off Electric Outlet, one of the Steve Jordan tunes, because I knew it inside and out. Everything Jordan played on that.
So, when Ferroni came up to you after that, was he like really kind of, was he cool or was he kind of stern, man?
He was stern with a little bit of a cracked smile, with like a little, like he knew what he was
making
doing.
His point,
and
though.
I bet one of the other guys said, "Go get him. Go tell him."
Yeah,
he's scared of you. I was like hip hop punk, I was really, I wanted to be playing in a hip hop band during that entire time, because I was in a hip hop band prior to that in Boston called Fatbag, and we had, it was kind of like we had a lead singer, rapper, the horn section, and a DJ, and I really wanted, so I was just kind of like, I'm gonna play my hip hop shit, and they said, "Go get him,"
But how stern can it be with an English accent?
Right.
You know?
Hey, man.
It sounds elegant.
He's a big imposing dude. He's no small guy.
There's a recent one with Steve that he talks about Clapton and he just pulls no punches. I think he can take care of himself.
Yeah, he's straight.
Don't let that accent throw you. Yeah.
Right. No, he's a big dude too. So, he sat me down and he just gave me this little thing. It was cool. It lasted 5 minutes, and I enjoyed it because I would say the same thing. I have said the same thing to it. When I hear kids, if they ask me, you know, what do you think of this lettuce cover or something, I'm like, well, you know, check out the record, you know, like something like that. It's a little different than that. Or I'll let them know in a nicer, cooler way than, I guess. Yeah, but Ferroni just, you know, reminded me of the, you know, the patterns and how important the patterns are. And it, you know, just in case I was the kid messing with his patterns every night, which I wasn't, you know, I would have really benefited from that speech, you know?
Yeah.
But basically for 2 years prior to that, I played pretty much his thing transcribed from Person to Person live, their only live record from the 70s. And I knew exactly everything he played. I bet I could play stuff he forgot he played on that record. Yeah. You know,
well,
but
that's
like,
cool. It shows, you know, coming from someone, Steve's a really selfless player. And so he has every right to be like, look, this song.
He's the king, man. I'll put on Person to Person live right now, you know, and listen to the whole thing beginning to end. Like, it's just so funky. And his hi-hat accents, his snare, his space and his fills. No one does that anymore. Right. Everyone fills it up with toms. He's a snare, hi-hat, kick, fill guy. And that's my whole thing. That's where I get, that's where I start my ideas from. You know, things that work off of grooves, you know, and that's Steve's world. He's a king, you know, so. Great thanks, stuff. Steve. Thanks for the lesson, Steve.
So, man, when you finished up that gig, what happened after that? What was after Average White Band? Well, first off, where were you living at that time?
I was living in New York.
Okay,
I was kind of going back and forth. I had a girlfriend in Boston, so I was back and forth between New York and Boston. And I luckily got to go straight from Average White Band to Schofield, which is rare. Usually when you get off a gig or you leave a gig, you have time downtime. But while I was with Average White Band in the third year, that's when the Lettuce gig featuring... 1 week was featuring Fred Wesley from the JBs, and the next week was featuring Schofield as a guest. And I was waiting for that. I couldn't wait. You know, I was super into it. I was a huge Dennis Chambers fan, and that's when Schofield came down, and we played that tune. And he called me the next day and said, "Hey, man, it's John. You know, you want to go on tour?" And I said, "Sure. You know, yes." So, and I had to inform Average White Band, and they were totally cool. It was totally vibe, you know, nice vibe. And we're friends to this day. We actually just talked to Ani McIntyre yesterday, original guitar player. Yeah. And he calls Nigel all the time. He loves Nigel, our singer Nigel. They're like best friends, you know. But so it went very smooth transition to Schofield and the Uber Jam Band.
Cool. Man, so I think it's interesting because one of the questions I actually had that you kind of jumped into it was that you did do some of the Schofield Fusion stuff with him. Did you do stuff off of like the Still Warm album and like the Omar Hakim stuff?
I mean, I went into that situation thinking we were going to like continue Still Warm, you know?
Right,
like,
yeah.
And he, from first day, he was like, nah, man. He was like, I did that. I love it. You love it. I mean, that's great that you love it. I am on some new stuff. I'm trying to explore over one chord, you know, and kind of just create, you know, polychords and all kinds of different kind of chords over one thing. So we created these grooves, and his concept was drums drop out, bass drop out, just bass, just drums and guitar, just two guitars. Like, so he had this concept of like muting certain instruments at different parts. You know, and those were like more of the chord changes than, you know, the actual chords changing, you know. So he put me onto his new concept, and I got it. And it took me a while to like kind of erase all my preconceived like Steve Jordanisms or Dennis Chambersisms and not copy that and try to find a place between Billy Martin and Bill Stewart and what Dennis did and it kind of bridge that all together, you know.
Hit, man, how long were you with John? Because I know you ended up doing a couple of albums with
him, we did
right?
3 years about.
Yeah.
Yeah, all over. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we did two albums. Yeah.
Right.
We did three albums, but we did two during that era, and then we did one after that recently.
Yeah, and all this still based, you were basing yourself out of New York at that time.
Yes, I was in New York, Manhattan. Yeah.
Cool. Go ahead, John.
Let me throw a curveball real quick. Get into it. I just want to ask a question that seems nobody asks. New York drummer, wholly different world than guy in Wichita, gigging at the bar down the street. give us an idea of how different that is. Like a gig at the Bitter End, for example. What does that entail for you as a New York drummer when you're in town and playing? It's just something that I just think a lot of people have no idea about. House kits, what exactly happens like typically in a New York setting?
It's pretty professional as far as cities go, as far as that's concerned, you know. If you've never been to New York, I would recommend, you know, going to the West Village and start with a Cafe Wa kind of vibe, check out the funk cats down there. You know, and then you have across the street, you have Groove, which is a great spot to go hang out and hear some. Every night of the week is usually funky. You know, a couple of us used to play there, you know, and Zinc Bar is a straight ahead thing where you catch Jeff Tane Watts, you know, just the local thing. And you have Revive Alive, which is a community of jazz musicians, of young, sometimes Wally's crew, Boston crew, and they're a huge force in New York, the Revive Alive thing. And I've seen, you know, Robert Glasper and Chris Dave doing a lot of Revive Alive events. Right. And when they first started their experiment together, before Robert Glasper had all the Grammys, and he was just this young guy that moved to New York and was playing with Chris Dave, and they had an experimental hip-hop fusion thing, jazz thing going on, and took New York by storm. And so New York is an amazing place, and you know, there's clubs like the Bitter End are always going to be there, hopefully, and you know, I've had some amazing shows there and all over the city. Clubs that have closed down, you know, the Wetlands, and now it's Brooklyn Bowl. And
what are the challenges of gigging in that city?
You know, finding your own way. There's people that don't tour and they play the local gigs, so you know, you can't just think you're gonna get a gig Cafe Wall every Tuesday or every other Tuesday, you know, because there's a guy that stays home and probably has a family, and he probably supports that family with that gig. So, you know, sitting in is one thing, but working in these clubs and getting a spot is tough. You have to be friends with the people that are the house people, and once you understand how that works, and not to step on anyone's toes or not go to the owner or the other band members and say, hire me, you know, that right. stuff. You got to be cool, and you got to know the drummers that you're dealing with and who's around. And all of a sudden, everyone starts calling everybody else.
Sure.
And it becomes this community of like, oh, you're in New York. Cool, man. You live down the street. All right. Well, I can't make next Tuesday. Can you do that? You know, that thing happens. And, you know,
then gear wise, is it typically?
Yeah, they always, yeah. Cafe Y always has a great kit. And, you know, Groove has, you don't have to bring drums to a lot of those gigs, you know. Yeah.
That was kind of what I was getting at, is that challenge versus, you know, a smaller city or whatever. You can drive right up to the venue. And
that's
you know, you have a little more. I just think a lot of people aren't aware of that.
Yeah. I mean, the city's, you know, it's pretty pro as far as cities go. You know, I really enjoy the New York scene, you know, but I had to get out of it. That's why I moved to Denver, because I was going to the same haunts all the time and seeing the same people. And, you know, and then every time I'd play in Denver, there'd be a huge community of music lovers. You know, there wasn't as big of a music scene. And that's what New York was. It seemed like it was like all musicians and not enough people that were going out to see them almost, you know, because everyone, there's all like the high-end clubs and the discos and all that stuff where, you know, Colorado people want to see music, you know.
Yeah,
so
no doubt.
I
know that jam band scene.
They love the electronic scene, electronic funk scene, which is happening now, which is hybrid live with computers kind of thing. Like, I'm into all that stuff, you know. So
how long have you been in Denver?
What's that? In Denver, about a year, a little over a year.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I like that city.
Yeah, it's a nice city.
It is, man. Yeah. You have any problem with altitude sickness up there?
No, I'm actually, everyone thinks you're going to get that. It goes away in a day, you know. Only if you go up to Telluride, which is the Telluride Jazz Festival, that's where you start feeling it. Where's the oxygen tank, you know?
I want to go a little early.
Is it just me, or am I the only person that hates flying into Denver, man?
It's actually one of the most beautiful airports ever.
The old airport, it was sheer misery.
I was talking about turbulence, the new one's man.
Pretty cool.
It seems like I get hammered with turbulence, man. Every time I get
once in a while, I haven't gotten too much turbulence. You know, all I know is it is a beautiful airport, and I spend most of my time at airports, so it's great to be able to go there and see like a sunrise or a sunset, and it's just a very well thought out airport. You know,
my only issue is LaGuardia. a jump from like Denver to Aspen, those flights can be rough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In general, like that airport is great. I don't, do you remember Stapleton at all?
No, I don't. I don't.
Oh, it was misery.
Okay.
You take off and you're like, there's a mountain right in front of
you. Oh, that's scary. That sounds like Telluride. Yeah.
Yeah, it's brutal. Like, and that was a national, yeah, big airport. So like,
yeah. Yeah, I plan to tell you why I would Schofield a bunch, and every time he told me we were flying in, I was like, "Uh-oh, here we go." You know,
man, you had mentioned electronics. I wanted to talk to you about that a little bit. When did you get involved in working with those? And it could even be, man, electronics from the standpoint of like recording, you know, software, all the way up to, of course, you know, sampling and drum machines, sequences, loops.
Yeah, my father was a tech head. You know, even though he's a drummer, he was really interested in synthesizers and samplers, and he had a partner that they had this thing called MIDI-Tech, which was explaining musical instrument digital interface and its possibilities to elementary schools. He was doing that at an elementary school level, I have no idea, because he just wanted to like spark these kids, you know, like, and have them see it and have them sample their voice and do all that stuff. You probably saw the Cosby Show where Stevie samples the kids, you know, and jamming on the one, you know, that thing. So, you know, he started this whole thing, and I was messing around with his keyboards, and there was wires all over the basement, and I wasn't allowed to touch anything. I couldn't turn anything off, you know, but it was just really intense and, you know, musical, electronic music thing going on in my dad's, in the 80s, you know, in the late 80s. So I got kind of into it, but more into the hip hop side of it, you know, NPCs and samplers, and I would love the way I would play my drums into one microphone, put it through an ASR-10 sampler, and then I would run it through all these different, you know, filter effects. Mm-hmm. And then one was like called like super big bass or super bottom filter, and it would just make my kit sound really amazing. Like, and just when one 57 mic, and I was like, wait a minute, this is like incredible. And then I would run a snare drum mic into it again, and run it through a guitar amp, you know. And that, so I got into like different miking techniques through sampling, and like, and that's what kind of got me into having a concept of a drum sound, or how I want to sound in the studio, basically.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that also comes up all the time, man, on the show is we talk about, you know, 20, 25 years ago, who would have thought that virtually every gig you do now, or every gig that we do now, is to some type of a loop, sequence, click.
Yeah.
Do you do that with Lettuce very much, as far as like loop sequences?
No, I refuse.
What about clicks? Do you guys play with clicks?
No clicks.
Yeah.
No clicks. You know, we really look forward to those times where if I want to just push the time a little bit, if we're playing some up-tempo stuff and sax player's burning or the guitar, and I want to just, you know, raise it up a notch and bring it up 2 BPM, so be it. Like, that's natural. That's music. Human, you know? Yeah. And sometimes we play in a medium tempo groove and it just feels a little rushed, and I could pull it back just a little bit. Like, we don't want to lose that, you know, the human element. That's why I come to Lettuce, to get away from machines. You know, that's why I have Break Science, which is like, that's done to a click. I have drum sounds that I meticulously programmed and fills within things. And and I can either play the fill that's in the track, or I can play something against it, or lay out and let just the machine do it, you know? So I have all these choices where, you know, I could just play off what I programmed. And that's what Break Science is. It's a lot of fun for me. And it's, in a way, it's conceptually the opposite of Lettuce, you know?
Right.
You know, it's all to a click, and it's, you know, it's me trying to lock as best possible with a track, but not to the point where it's like I am using the triggers, so I'm not stuck with the actual pattern of the song. I like having a little bit of freedom. And if I just want to play some Tony Williams stuff on top, I can, you know, like, you know, within reason, you know.
That's cool. Where did you, was there a teacher, or was there something that you just decided, as far as like, I've got to learn how to play with a click, because everybody learns about, you know, playing with clicks and sequences in different ways.
Yeah.
You know, when did that come to the forefront of like your practice?
I would have to say it was playing with hip-hop records. And my dad had drum machines in the house.
Yeah.
I was just one of those rare kids that had a lot of things, toys to play with. And so, yeah, we had the Roland TR-626 or something like that. And, you know, it was before the 808, you know, or something like that. And it was just really, the crash cymbal used to cut off. Psh!
Yeah.
Pegadome. Psh! you know. But I would program these, like, you know, kind of conga meets cowbell. And I just practiced with that for hours and hours and hours. It was just fun to me. It wasn't like, I never realized that it was this pressure situation in Nashville and L.A. where you have to, they pull on a click and you got a band, you got to go, I didn't understand that it was just like, people were saying it's stressful. I was like, this is fun, you know, like, but then I realized, you know, later on that, you know, sometimes if you can't hear the click and the band's a little loud and you start playing, you go to the chorus and the click's gone, you can't really hear it. That's when people start stressing out. So yeah. I like to use the click, and I like to make sure it's the right level. And I sometimes I'll replay it with a cowbell, with my own self playing it, and I'll put a little tambourine and loop that. Then you play with it, and it's way more easy. And you're locked to the grid, so they can take your fill from the first chorus and put it in the third chorus, you know, that stuff. So it's just way easier to play with it when you can hear it, and it's natural, and it's a loop of you playing some click like thing, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. John,
I like it. I'm gonna try to incorporate that more.
Yeah.
Just sometimes that relentless.
Yeah, just that one click. It's like, who are we trying to be? Like, you know, God, it's that weird, just that metronome click. It's like, nah, it's like if you have a shaker, you just go to egg shaker and just snap on two and four and just have them loop two bars of that.
Yep.
You know, and you play over that, and it's like, ah, that feels natural. That's my, so you don't feel like you have to lock to this inhuman.
Yeah.
Playing with Rob McDonald, man.
What's that?
You're playing with Rob McDonald.
Right, you know? Exactly. It should feel like Ralph. Yeah, right. You know, Ralph is the dude, you know.
I mean,
yeah.
Psychologically, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, man.
Adam, I want to talk about one other gig and then spend some time on Lettuce. Mm. From another interview, I heard a little bit about your time when you were with Michelle in Degiacello.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not necessarily a great time for you.
It was a really great time and a high level of learning,
right?
And getting better and learning to be strong in confidence wise and not be broken too hard.
Well, the thing
I'm in retrospect,
right? You know. What I want to talk about is. At the time that was happening, mm-hmm. man, me, John, everybody we've had gigs, whether they be road gigs, local one-off gigs, where somebody is down your freaking throat about one thing or another.
Mm.
Man, what was going on in your mind, man, at that time? In other words, how did you rationalize it and then make the gig happen?
Well, she was coming, you know, this was her jazz exploratory thing. She was playing the Blue Note in Japan, and she wanted to bring a new band to Japan and that incorporated more of a jazz aesthetic, like a almost like a Tony Williams meets Chris Dave thing, you know, like. And I was a little behind the times with her thing, and I was still loving her old funky stuff that I, you know, Gene Lake and, you know, and that's where I was coming from. And she was past that, you know, peace beyond passion. She had already gone into this, like, almost, this was her Bitches Brew moment. Yeah. And I was called to replace Chris last minute. And Chris is at the time was, you know, really filling up a lot of the space with a lot of Tony Williams language, a lot of his version of Roy Haynes and his, you know, on top of, you know, kind of like these, like, odd time grooves that she had going. So I walked into it blind, and I had to rationalize it as I wasn't prepared, and there's no way I could have been prepared, like, unless I had really, you know, knew where she was going to let go of her, the old style of her that I love. Similar to Scofield, like, whereas Scofield, I wanted to go into it playing Steve Jordan 1987, you know, and then I realized that's not where he's at, you know, and I adjust, you know. Don't put an artist in a thing, you know. If you get the gig with somebody, let the artist dictate where they're at now, you know. Lose all preconceptions, you know.
Accommodate.
Yeah, you get a gig with James Taylor, he may want to do a funk record. Who knows? You know, like, you know, you just see where they're at now and don't assume they're gonna So I kind of assumed Michelle was going to do, if that's your boyfriend, oh, that, yeah, I thought she was going to do that, and she was somewhere completely different. And it took me a while to adjust, and by the last couple gigs, I started to kind of express myself in a sort of just out a lot of, you know, just Tony, 70s Tony vibe, and it started to get started to make sense a little more. But that was a tough time.
Yeah, man, sometimes just the mental aspect of that, man, just getting out of your own head, you know, is the hardest part, man, of that type of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so I suppose, man, when to actually make that happen for yourself, did you, like, talk to, like, the other members in the band? Did you?
Oh, they were consoling me. I was, like, near tears, you know? They were like, it's all right, man. You sounded great, man. Like, yeah, that's why, you know, again, with my guys and their,
thank God
their ability to bring me out of the dumps of you know, the mental place where we all have that thing where it's like, man, like, you know, I gotta get it together, you know, and it has a tendency to, you know, it can drag you down a little bit and make you, and then it's really up to your friends and sometimes to bring you up in a certain way, and, you know, and they really were responsible for, you know, because I would play with them after, so it was four sets a night, Michelle band, then Lettuce, then Michelle band, then Lettuce. So I was playing four a night, and it was if they're knocking, they're not part of it. Why is that door open? Oh, there you are. Oh, you good? I was talking about Michelle and Blue Note. Yeah, but thanks to guys like Eric Coombs, I was very he made me feel a lot better about playing with her, and that, and said, just keep doing what you're doing. You know, and you're grooving, and the band sounds great, you know, and, like, because I was so depressed during that era, you know, like, just, like, it was hard to play with her. I was, like, trying to, you know, do what she wanted me to do, and I didn't have the knowledge at that point to do it.
Right, yeah.
Thank God you had some people there, because sometimes you can be out on that island, man. Everybody's vibing you.
Been there,
you know,
man.
And that can just be so brutal.
It sucks.
It's brutal, man. It's, you know, because you can't beat yourself up too much. You got to just try to figure it out. You know, it's a problem, and you just got to, what does the band leader truly want from the situation? You know, and she wanted me to fill up space, and my thing is to leave space. So my thing of leaving space and her things of filling up space, they were conflicting. It was contrasting, and that's why she wasn't happy. So when I started to play a little bit more unnaturally busy for me, that's when it started to come together, I guess.
You know? Right. And then you kind of had to embrace the fact that, hey, you know, this is not necessarily me, but it is for the artist.
Yes.
You know?
Being selfless at that point to make the artist feel good is an important part of being a musician, I think. Unless you're going to, you know, especially if you're playing for an established, well-known artist.
If you're a sideman, that's the whole gig.
Yeah,
absolutely. So Lettuce was on that gig then. Is what you're saying? Was Lettuce the backup band for her at that time?
No. She had her own band.
Okay.
It was Lettuce's own band, and she had Michelle and Diego Cello. I guess I don't know what that project was called. I can't remember, but it was Gene Lake's brother was the DJ.
Okay.
And Oliver Lake, Gene Lake's father, was the saxophonist.
It's like deja vu, man. We were talking about this on the way up here.
St. Louis guys.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
I go back to, like, there's a lot of history there.
Yeah, it was like the Lake Oliver family with no Gene. So here I am, like, playing in front of the Lake family. I'm like, oh, no. Like, you know, Gene. Just because I already worshipped Gene by that era, you know, by that time, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty intense. And then I forget the pianist's name. It was incredible. And there was another trumpet player. I can't remember. But they were all seriously bad cats. Like, really killing, you know, on the fringes of jazz and fusion, and, you know, not really coming from the funk thing where I'm from, you know. So it was great to just play with these amazing musicians, and they were great and they were cool to me, you know. It was just her, she was trying to bring more out, you know, and to this day when I see her, we laugh about it. She thinks, like, that, Adam, you scared of me? You know, like,
yeah.
You it's know. Just Chris Day, man. Come
on. Yeah. It was like, you know, Chris was like looming, you know, like,
whoa.
I call it the Chris Dave effect, the CDE.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what he's done to just drumming in general. And it's amazing. He's an artist, you know, and he's hilarious. He's a funny dude, you know. So I think a lot of his ideas come from humor, you know, his sense of humor, too. Like, he's got some things that make absolutely no sense on the drums that are brilliant in an artistic way, you know, and it cracks me up sometimes how incredible he is. So
I think Bill Stewart's another example. He'll make you laugh.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think that's a great thing to do on an instrument, if you could do that in a non-jivey way, like right, just by playing some musical phrase that's like funny somehow. You know, like Chris can do that to me.
It's definitely got to be genuine.
Yeah.
You know, like from someone that truly is seeing it as opposed to just, you know, being a jerk, you know, like, yeah.
Right, right. The serious guy. You
like
know.
You say, Chris is really funny.
He's really funny. And he'll crack a little smile. He'll do some really outlandish thing that sounds like your brain is skipping or something. And he'll smile. You see him smile and it makes you crack up. You know.
So, man, you'd mentioned then that Lettuce was on the bill with Michelle, and you were alternating sets. Was that what it was? So now let's go full circle here. Lettuce has kind of been the thread that goes straight through all this stuff, and that's why we're here today, right?
Mm, absolutely.
I mean, we're here for this gig.
Yep.
So I mean, you guys have been together literally from the roots of this thing when you were 16 years old when you first met over there. So I know this is good. This is a loaded and hard question here. But give us we'll call it the Reader's Digest version of where you guys started, all right, and where you're at now. Because, I mean, we're sitting on a Prevost, guys, in the front lounge of this thing right now, okay? So they didn't start out in a Prevost.
No, man. And
I'm going to say there's cars and vans involved in this story, right?
Oh, yeah.
So just give us a little bit of detail as far as, like, where we're at now, in other words, as far as like where you came from and what's next also.
I mean, you know, there were gigs at the beginning where, you know, I slept in a staircase on a random mattress, you know, in the dorms at random colleges, you know, sleeping in vans, sleeping on the floor of the van. Like when you can't really, so many people in the van, you can't sleep. So you go on the floor of the van, you know, and it's just like, you know, there's from, you know, and it was just, we still love playing the music so much that the lifestyle of being in vans so much across the country and you know, locally, that it didn't bother us to the point of not wanting to do it. You know, and that's the true test, I think. Like, can you get through those stiff necks and those sleepless drives and the person that wants to put on music too loud or the person that won't play music? And what's that?
Just being on top of each other alone.
Yeah, it's being shoulder to shoulder with your other soldiers all the time, you know.
Everybody getting sick, you know.
That too. Yeah. And you know, if you can get through all that, and you still love playing, you get to the gig and you're excited still, you got something going on, you know. And I knew that with these guys, and you know, early on, we always had too much fun. Even in the van rides, we're, no matter how tight, he's cracking us up, and we were always laughing. And you know, we like to listen to reggae in the van a lot. It kind of keeps us in a nice, chill, Irie vibe, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, we did vans for years, and I don't even remember our first bus tour. We were like jumping the entire tour for joy, like, you know, like, it was just, we still can't believe we're on this bus. There's not one second that goes by where we look at each other and aren't completely thankful and completely are those guys from when we were 17 and wishing we had this. Like, this is a total dream.
How long ago was that when you got the first bus tour?
Oh man, how long have we been doing bus tours?
Two or three years,
right? Yeah. At most.
It's important for everybody to do some math right now.
Yeah.
And figure out that these guys are freaking road warriors.
I think they're committed.
They are committed.
Yeah.
And so now, Adam, let's contrast that with like a typical gig day now. Mm. You know what I mean? Because you're not riding in vans anymore.
Yes.
So you got this. So, and let me go ahead and say this. We saw the Lettuce sound check. So everybody, I'm telling you right now, you need to come out and see these guys, these guys play. So we've got to see a nice sound check. But walk us through just a rough day, man. Like, in other words, what's your gig day like now?
Yeah, it's, you know, we wake up, do a little yoga stretch, you know, a little downward dog, some sit-ups, do some push-ups, drink a green juice or a Suja organic drink, and, you know, try to be as healthy as you can, get some stuff done, go for a walk around the town. And it all builds to this excitement of sound check, which is smack in the middle of your day. And sound check is what, for a lot of bands, sound check is a drag. And for us, once in a while, it's a drag. For most of the time, it's extremely fun. It's like almost, I don't want to say even more fun than the show, but it, we try things out, and it's all, some new things happen, and it's really incredible. And so we look forward to that hour and a half sound check thing, and that's first show of the day. You know, say,
people need to realize, man, they're really getting their money's worth.
Yeah,
because you guys are working it. You know, I know there's plenty of ideas flowing, just tightening some stuff up, but not phoning it in, just at sound check. So when you're at their show, know that.
Thank you, man.
Bringing it, man. That's
We're the opposite of the band that just shows up, that doesn't hang out, and then shows up for the gig, jumps on stage, plays, and splits up. Like, we're the opposite of those guys. We're the band that hangs out all day, thinks about the tunes, and after sound check, we hang out and write a set together, and we come up with different set suggestions, and we make like a live record, you know, based on these old tunes that we have, and new tunes, and new arrangements, and old arrangements. So, you know, the entire day is, we treat it like a real job, you know, like, you know, if you work for Facebook, you take it seriously. You work all day long. You do, you know, whoever you work for should really, you know, take it seriously. So we, the entire day is a build up to the show, you know, and then after the show is, you know, we hear stories of Kobe Bryant, you know, guys like that watching the game after the game, and, you know, and Miles Davis demanding and Prince demanding to have the tapes played in his bus after the show, you know.
You guys do a lot of that?
And that's, I was like, oh, we have to do this. You know, I did a lot with Scofield because I want, you know, the sound guy was a good friend of mine, Pat Murray, and he'd record every night. And, you know, I didn't want to imagine that it was great or imagine it was horrible. I wanted to let the tape be the truth teller.
It tells the truth.
You know, the tape will not lie, you know. And some nights I thought were amazing and they weren't. And some nights I thought they were the horrible and they were the best nights, you know? And you, the only way you really know that is by going, spending that time and spending that hour with your recording, you know, of that gig that night, you know?
And we're talking about, you know, like Scofield's gig, it was a creative gig from what you've said, where it you know, really on the spot and that.
Right. And a lot of it, you won't remember
even hearing that it's working.
What's that?
Even hearing a new idea, if it's working or not, it translates. That's huge.
That's what it's about. You might play something one time that was like really cool for the song, and if you don't listen to that recording, you'll forget it, and you'll go into, oh, let me try this here, and then you come up with 100 different ideas, and you forgot that one thing that was really fit the tune, you know. Yeah. So I like to, you know, go back and listen to recordings. So the entire day is a build up to playing the show, and then a little bit of a hang, and then listening to the show, sleep.
Cool.
Yeah. Hey. Got to stay healthy when you're on the road. That's for sure.
Yeah, you can't go too crazy. You know,
Adam, we're about to power down, but there's just a few more questions to ask you on this. When you get home, when you get to Denver, what do you do?
Oh, go on the couch, my lovely girlfriend who I haven't seen, and God bless her. She loves that I do this, and you know, loves the music and loves the band and loves. Understands this, and so I go hang out with her, and you know, and she goes to sleep, and I'll probably go sneak upstairs to my studio and make some more music. You know, I get into my production thing. I have Break Science, countless hours of work to do with, you know, fixing snare sounds, mixing, adding all kinds of effects to the, you know, the synthesizer track or whatever it is. You know. It's hours and hours of me and my, you know, bandmate Bormley, and we sit there for hours and hours. And so a lot of work when I get home is spent in my studio with Borm, going through all the Break Science, you know, especially when we're in an album creation period right now. So that's what it is.
Does your girlfriend, does she have like just like a straight gig kind of a thing?
Or no, she doesn't. Or? She doesn't. And okay. That's why it's great for
so
us.
She
because
understands
it. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, so... Yeah, it works when she's able to come with me and for a lot of the stuff. And yeah, she's definitely seen a lot of my life. It's great. So, yeah, so that I'll basically, you know, do some hanging and then do some recording. And I'll wake up and I'll play some straight ahead, play like a Roy Haynes album or, you know, some Joe Chambers or something, you know, like that.
Cool.
Art Taylor.
We talked about the other day. There's some really great drummerless records.
Drummerless.
Oscar Peterson and Drummerless.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Straight Ahead Records, yeah. Brady Brown, you know.
Yeah, man.
Play along with those and it's
oh,
just
it's cool, so great, man. There's a album with Ron Carter and Houston Person, a duet record.
Yeah.
And they're playing like some really great tempos, medium, slow tempos. And yeah, you play Brushes to that record, you wake up in the morning, it's like, ah, it's going to be awesome. A great day, you know? Like,
Adam, do you have anything like lettuce related, break science related you want to promote? Any projects coming up? Anything you want to tell the folks about?
The most recent Lettuce release is Mount Crushmore. It's just an EP. And before that was the album Crush, if you can get a chance to check those out. The Break Science album is untitled right now, and just finishing that. I have the Adam Deitch Quartet album, which features two of the horn players, Eric Bloom and Ryan Zotis from Lettuce, with a great organist from San Francisco, from the Bay Area, Will Blades. Yeah, Will is a student of Dr. Lonnie Smith, and he's just a really phenomenal in the cracks between jazz and funk. And he also has a group with Billy Martin from Modesky Martin and Wood. He does a duo thing. So I got Will for my quartet, and it's sort of I wrote a couple tunes based on my love of Wayne Shorter and his Speak No Evil period. And I kind of wanted to put a little bit of a groove underneath that, but not overt funk, you know, just a light funk,
right?
You know, kind of like the old Idris Muhammad kind of style. And it's kind of
just
that.
Talking about all this vibe.
Yeah,
it's
man.
Amazing, man.
You know, I put
not heavy handed.
Not heavy handed. You know, I don't want to necessarily be like pigeonholed into being a heavy handed guy or a light hitter or what. I like to fit the music as best as possible and still retain what I think is me. But, you know, have fun with being a chameleon at the same time.
Man, you mentioned also a little while ago, you were talking about, you know, the importance of you know, helping people up. You know, you achieve a certain level of success and you help other folks as
Absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Man, any advice you would like to give any other drummers or musicians?
It depends on what stage of your career you're at. I've been through a lot of scenarios, you know. So you know, if you do have any questions for me, you can always write me, you know, a question on my Facebook messages. If you have a really particular drum question, anyone out there, I'm always available, you know. Besides, like, you know, what kind of snare do you use on this record, because I don't remember usually. I don't remember what cymbals I used on Uber Jam. I really don't. I know they were Zildjians, and if they're drums, they were Tama. And, like, you know, I'm not a super gear guy, but I'm really, you know, I love to talk about, you know, career choices and how to deal with almost every situation. You know, my thing is, you know, having a manager or a friend that's acting as your manager, if you find yourself juggling a few different gigs and you're missing calls and, you know, and you're having to, it helps to have a friend, even on a small level, that can negotiate for you. Money-wise and take care of that kind of stuff. If you've never thought about that, you should think about it. It could just be like one of your trustworthy friends that will field calls for you and kind of just facilitate, you know, you not having to tell people directly what you're worth, because that can get into a weird thing sometimes, yeah, you know. And I'd rather let my friend, you know, who's now my manager, Morgan, who's been with my manager for over 10 years, maybe longer. And yeah, he started off with just fielding drum calls and dealing with the occasional students and stuff like that. And it became the manager of Lettuce and became the manager of Break Science. And so, and he also used to take care of my drums in the city when I would play in front of 15 people and no one would show up and I'd get mad and walk home without packing my kit up. He would pack it up for me, you know, like just a good friend.
True friend.
And, you know,
no
yeah,
doubt.
Yeah.
You know, man, you mentioned, you said that he fields questions as far as students as well. Like, yeah. So you do teach then?
Yeah. I'm really inspired by what Mike Johnston's doing right now. I think that's the future of teaching.
The online thing.
The online thing. Yeah. Stanton's doing a online drum school, and I just dig it. I think that can reach way more people, and I've reached out to Mike a few times about for advice about how to do that. Another guy, Carter McLean, you know this guy, Carter?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great educator, really cool guy. He plays in Lion King.
Great player.
Yeah, man, like groove central, you know?
Touch.
So these guys are what, to me, like the future of education, drum educator, music education, you know? And they do some Skype stuff, and they also have camps, and they also, you know, and I want to do all this, you know, but I'm really concentrating on touring right now, and that's why Stanton's kind of like, you know, he's got the touring thing, he's got the teaching thing, he's got it all together, you know, like, so I'm always, you know, picking his brain and how does he do all of that, you know, but I love to teach and I try to do, you know, a lesson here and there when I can. Gotcha. In the meantime, until I get my online game happening.
Adam, you've been unbelievable, man.
Thanks, man. You guys are asking those loaded questions, the good ones, though.
Well, let me say this. It's not over yet. As you could tell, we like to have a little bit of fun here on the show. And I'm gonna tell you this. We're going to spring a little surprise on you here at the very end of the show. Little John did it. He was a good sport.
I'm in.
And so here's what we're going to do. I've written out what we call the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast Rorschach Test.
Okay.
It's a personality test. What we do is we give you a list of about 20 questions. We send it off to the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast think tank. We have them analyze you, and we get back to you. All right?
Great. All right.
So these are just little short questions. I don't want you to overthink these, man. It's going to be literally like I'm going to go, hey, Coke or Pepsi, and you would go, whatever. It's a little short questions, all right?
Yeah, Mountain Dew.
Yeah, so you can tell it's going to be serious. I'm putting on my glasses, man, so I can see these.
All right.
John, start the clock.
Nah.
All right, here we go. Wood tip or nylon tip?
Wood tip.
In-ears or wedges?
In-ears.
Jets or Giants?
Giants.
Clyde or Jabbo?
Clyde.
Pat Boone, Debbie Boone, or Face Melter?
Pat Boone, Debbie Boone.
What's your favorite TV show?
I really like Quantico right now.
Right on.
It's about CIA life.
Remember I said we were going to call back something? Long Island Drum Center or Manhattan Drum Shop?
I'm Long Island Drum Center in Nyack all day, yeah.
Got it. Hard cases or bags?
Hard cases for tour, bags for home.
Got it. Barbecue, pork or beef?
Man, I'm going to go with, I had some beef brisket yesterday. It was incredible. Beef.
Elvin or Tony?
What's that?
Elvin or Tony?
Woo-wee!
That's just unfair, man. I didn't come up with these, by the way.
Don't think too much,
okay,
man.
I'm just going to go Tony, man. He played funk records later in his life.
PC or Mac?
Mac all day.
When you're in Manhattan, drive or cab?
I don't even have a license, man.
That's going to be cab. Motown or Stax?
I do have a skateboard, though. Stax.
Up at dawn or up at the crack of noon?
Asleep at dawn, up at the crack of noon. No, definitely crack of noon.
Metal snare, wood snare?
Go wood.
You just got your dream gig. Who's the first person you call?
Mom, dad. Both of them.
Yes. Vintage gear or new gear?
New gear with a vintage aesthetic.
Coffee or tea?
I've been on some coffee recently.
Freddie White with Earth, Wind, and Fire or Freddie White with Donny Hathaway?
That is an excellent question. And I'm gonna go Earth, Wind, and Fire because I know everything he ever played it on Earth, Wind, Fire. Okay, go ahead.
And the money question. Jason Lee or Ray Barbie?
Wow. You did your research.
Man, they're not going to come after you, man. Just
no,
be honest.
Man. I had a Jason Lee board. I'm going to go Jason Lee. And he became an actor. So, you know, who knows? But
many
I love Ray Barbie. Ray Barbie had that
only
street style, you know, like, ooh.
Awesome.
You guys are great.
There you have it, guys. Adam Deitch, man, from Lettuce. How about that?
Next time we're just going to ask 400 questions. We're not going to talk about anything.
Cool. Yeah, we're just going to run it down.
An hour and a half.
Yes or no, true or false.
You know what? I'm going to leave this interview on a down note. How about this? Adam is a band leader, businessman. We didn't even talk about your record label, man. Yeah, with Royal Family. But quick question, since you're a businessman, did you pay your taxes today?
Oh, I have an accountant for that. Anton is all over that.
All right. All right, guys. So we're going to close this thing down. We're on the road. We'll be heading back to Atlanta soon. But big thanks to Adam Deitch and the guys from Lettuce, man. You've been wonderful, man. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You got it. Until next Monday, we'll see you guys then. Say bye, John.
Peace.
See you later. So there you have it, folks. Adam Deitch. Man, what a tremendous player and a wonderful guy. We had such a good time for the few hours we got to hang out. Got to hear about an hour and a half of him during soundcheck. He was absolutely killing it, as well as the rest of the guys. And before I forget, I want to thank the rest of the guys that hung out with us during the interview. As you heard during the actual show, there was a lot of coming and going. This was just a couple of hours before the actual gig, and so folks were coming in and out. They were very nice. They were giving us drinks and food. I want to thank Nigel from Lettuce, Eric, a.k.a. Jesus, and Adam, a.k.a. Schmeens. Man, just wonderful hanging out with you guys that night. And also, it is not lost on us here at the Drummers Weekly Groovecast, and certainly not by Adam and the guys in Lettuce, that the day that we taped this interview was also the day that we nearly lost one of the great drumming legends in history. Most of you folks will probably realize that David Garibaldi from Tower of Power, along with bassist Mark von Wageningen, were nearly killed by a train in Oakland, just in front of Yoshi's Jazz Club, just prior to a gig they were going to play. It's my understanding that David is doing quite well right now. He's certainly beat up, banged up a good bit. Mark von Wageningen seemed to have gotten the worst end of that deal. He underwent some pretty extensive surgery to stop some internal bleeding, but I think doctors are optimistic for a complete recovery for him as well. So we want to throw out big prayers and healing thoughts to David Garibaldi and Mark von Wageningen out in Oakland right now, convalescing and getting better. Can't wait to hear you guys make music again. So, before we get out of here, we'd like to go ahead and remind everyone to please stay in touch with us. We greatly appreciate your listenership, and we also appreciate your feedback. Please tell us ideas that you would like to hear, thoughts and concerns about things that are on the show. Greatly appreciate it. You can always email us at drummersweeklygroovecast@gmail.com. You can also tweet us at twitter.com/DWGroovecast. And you can interact with us on Facebook at facebook.com/DrummersWeeklyGroovecast. All right, so in honor of David Garibaldi and the rest of the folks in Tower of Power, I decided to put a little bed of music underneath this outro that I'm tagging on to the end of the interview. It's Tower of Power from the In the Slot album, the tune Ebony Jam, with that signature David Garibaldi groove at the beginning that I took a few liberties and looped it several times. It just sounds and feels so good. I know you guys don't mind hearing that, and I certainly know that Adam Deitch will sign off on this, as Garibaldi being one of his all-time heroes. So this is in honor of David Garibaldi from the Drummers Weekly Groovecast and Adam Deitch. And right after this, we're going to go ahead and finish off by playing a track from Lettuce, of course with Adam Deitch on drums. We hope you enjoy it. Thanks as always for listening. Subscribe to us today on your favorite podcast app. You can also find us on SoundCloud, Google Play Podcasts, Podbean, Stitcher, and iTunes. And when you're in iTunes, please, please stop by and give us a review. 5 stars, if you would. Just a quick sentence or two that would do us great. It helps us move up in the rankings and relates us to other shows that have similar kind of content and will grow our audience base. All right, guys, thanks again so much for listening to the show. Until next Monday, we'll see you then.